Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
Hello and my name's Jared John, and if I weren't so intensely tired, I'd have come up with a really funny, witty thing to say at the beginning of this podcast, but all you really need to know is that I voted to remain. How often do we meet? Weekly, sometimes, to talk about politics, social issues, oh my god, and current events.
Yeah, something like that. Some combination or variation of those three things.
Good enough.
Have you been enjoying Boris Johnson's premiership so far, Jazza? I know we're only a couple of weeks in, maybe only a week and a bit.
It's not nearly as entertaining as I thought it would be. I mean, he's done stuff like in his opening speech, he said that he was going to be a dude. Well, what did that stand for again? Like, dynamic... something and energetic or so like fine. He also called the United Kingdom of four major nations the awesome foursome. I'll be honest, from the guy who usually speaks Latin, his use of the English language has been a little bit lackluster, to be completely honest. Maybe he's used up all of them.
I think it's an improvement, to be honest. I think less Latin in public life can only be an improvement. So I'm on board with his new language policy.
I think that was the only thing that I was really looking forward to was more of our more obscure Latin quotes being integrated into our day-to-day lives. But oh well, you know, one can dream.
I mean, speaking of Latin quotes, did you see the style guide that Jacob Rees-Mogg produced for his staff?
Oh yes, the most wonderful dead cat in history.
What, you thought that was a dead cat?
Maybe to a certain extent, but it certainly stopped us talking about how terrible no deal would be for a couple of days.
I mean, if that's the strategy, I think they're going to have to come up with quite a lot of dead cats, as you put it, if distraction is the name of the game.
A lot of Jacob Rees-Mogg's style guide in terms of the grammar that he wants his staff to use is actually just incorrect English, which is a bit strange. But it was alongside
I'm going to have to query this. Or which bits do you think are incorrect per se?
He incorrectly used the Oxford comma, I believe.
Well, he incorrectly described it. It was the Oxford comma is when you put a comma before the and. So you say one, two, and three, and you'd put the comma after two. But he actually said in his instructions, don't put the comma after the and, which no one does anyway.
Put it actually above the and. You have to do it by hand.
I'm a big fan of the Oxford comma, actually. If it's a complicated list, if it's a simple list, then I think it's excessive. But I don't know that I can vote for Jacob Rees-Mogg in any capacity now. But I know that that's how he feels about the Oxford comma. I think that is a red line for me.
That was the red line for you. My God.
Yeah. And he didn't like the word equal. For some reason, I know that this material writes itself, but I don't understand.
The wonderful irony of the man who has never changed a nappy in his life, despite having eight children. The wonderful, wonderful irony of him banning the word equal from his staff.
I think he was also opposed to the word disappointment, which may be a word that people will be using over the next next couple of months. Making any predictions here.
What's your prediction, eh?
I mean, we should probably stop discussing his style guide, but it is out there.
It's a very effective dead cat.
Yeah, I mean, it's stopping the start of this podcast properly. So the first thing we are going to be discussing is Boris Johnson's premiership and the various people he's appointed to various posts and the general vote leave-y or Brexit-y character of those appointments. I think we'll be touching on.
I just want to highlight one thing here. Have you seen the Politico's introduction to all of the Johnson cabinet?
Yes, I have. I have read that.
They have the most wonderful text underneath each of the descriptions of the new cabinet members. So it's got Robert Jenkin, Jenrick, who is the Housing, Communities and Local Government Secretary, and under his photo it says, owns several expensive houses. For Amber Rudd, Work and Pension Secretary, they have her described as theatre buff. For the new Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, it says underneath his photo, pinches strawberry split ice lollies from his kids. So, you know, really insightful stuff there, Politico. I enjoyed it.
I mean, I think details like that can reveal a lot about someone, you know, in that is somebody who owns free houses really in touch with the renting and, you know, potentially mortgaging needs of the average member of the public? Probably not.
You know what? I don't think that Boris Johnson was necessarily going for a cabinet that really understood the everyman. But, you know.
But it is a very diverse cabinet, ethnically speaking.
Yeah, sure, ethnically speaking.
And that's what you want, Jazza, isn't it? That's the main thing when appointing cabinets.
I'm not going to complain that this is actually it's the most ethnically diverse cabinet in history, right? It's also more ethnically diverse than the country as a whole. But they are all nut jobs, so I can still be annoyed about that.
So the nut job to sane person diversity is not good in this cabinet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. And I don't want to rank the importance of different types of diversity, but I want the lowest number of nut jobs in my cabinets as possible, if that's okay.
That's very discriminatory. I was trying to get a
positive discrimination, though. I hope so.
In a way, yeah. But what's the second topic that we're going to be touching on?
So, some YouTubers in Germany are starting a union. Very exciting. And we're going to be talking about this because I wrote a 15,000 word master's thesis on it, and I'm a nerd. This comes off of the back of, coincidentally, I think, the Internet Creators Guild, United States-based attempt to collectively organize by the YouTube creator community. That folded about 3, 4, 5 weeks ago. And then afterwards, the YouTuber Union in Germany decided to found itself and has promptly started a clock for before it runs down. YouTube have to respond to their demands. Now, I work for YouTube, so cannot talk in terms of the YouTube side of this. But what I can give is a lot of lovely context, and Jimmy is allowed to then speculate. How does that sound?
That sounds pretty good to me, although my general ignorance of YouTubing, having not done it for ever, basically. It's quite high.
That's okay. That probably puts you in about the same category as every other journalist who has written about this topic.
Shit. That was a harsh burn, man. The tech journalist community did not need your scorn.
You know, hey, welcome to the way that academics always talk about journalists.
And finally, third and finally, we are going to be discussing the belated, I think is a fair word to use, resignation of Jared O'Mara, who is currently the Sheffield Hallam MP, replaced Nick Clegg in the June 2017 election in a poignant moment, I think, for Jazza especially. But O'Mara's been standing as an independent MP for... couple of months now, because he had an ongoing dispute with Labour. He originally, you know, won his seat as a Labour MP, and then he came in for a lot of flack because of slightly unsavoury comments he wrote on the internet coming to light, and more recently he's been accused of sexual harassment, and his attendance record in Parliament's not been very good for quite a long time. And recently one of his communications staff made a quite spectacular resignation announcement on O'Mara's own Twitter account, sort of calling him a disgraceful human being and insulting him quite grievously, I think. And since then, O'Mara's actually said that he's not going to be running for office again, which is a reversal of his previous stance, and he's going to be resigning in September.
If there isn't an election, could mean a by-election in Sheffield Hallam, which could be another opportunity for the United Remain Alliance to get themselves another seat.
Jazz has just been bringing it back to Brexit then, as always, but I think it's, you know, more than that angle. It's an interesting incident of how Parliament doesn't really have HR policies, or has HR policies that are so ineffective that it's, you know, a major failing, I think, of parliamentary life at the moment. So we're going to be discussing all of that after we play some music and beg you for money. Jazzy, do you have anything else to say in this introduction?
I'm so intensely tired.
Aren't we all? Hi there. If you're enjoying The Right Dishonourable, and we hope you are, there are various ways that you can support the show. Probably the easiest way is to go to twitter.com/rightdishonour, follow us there, send us any feedback you have, what you think we might be able to improve about the show, what you're liking about the show, all that sort of stuff. If you want to send us a bit of money, you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. That's just a standard Patreon account, so I'm sure most of you know how that works. As always, we'd like to thank our current patrons, David Warner, Emerson Sparks, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for your support, and hopefully more people will be joining you very soon. Jazza, when you were looking at the cabinet appointments for Boris Johnson's premiership, did you get the sense at all that this was the sort of cabinet that should have been running things in the first Tory leadership election after David Cameron stepped down, the one that Theresa May won and Boris Johnson crashed out of unexpectedly?
Frankly, I want as few of these people as possible near to any kind of decision making as is allowed, to be fair. Boris Johnson, I think, is probably going to turn out to be, if not disappointing, one of the worst prime ministers that we've ever had. Watch me eat my words there. Stavid Javid is documented as being an opportunistic career climber in the wake of one of the greatest national tragedies that we have had in this country with Grenfell. He's the new chancellor. Dominic Raab didn't know that Dover was an important factor in us being able to get goods in and out of the country.
I think, to be fair really to him, he didn't realize.
Secretary, I am not done.
Right, stop. He didn't realize the extent of the trade that went through Dover Calais, which, to be honest, I don't think most people know that. I don't know that right now.
Yeah. But it's literally his job, Jimmy.
I mean, it was when he made that statement. So, and he had found out that at that point. I think most people don't know the extent of the trade between Dover and Calais, what proportion of our exports or imports come through that particular channel. I just think it's an overstated criticism. Do continue.
And then Priti Patel, you're probably going to think this is an overstated criticism as well. Priti Patel, who very clearly says, I think that we should have capital punishment as a deterrent, never admits that she wants to bloody kill anybody, though. But then says, what I said about capital punishment in 2011 was taken out of context. I never said it. Literally, the video is everywhere. Google it. She's terrifying, that lady. Been in charge of everything that she's basically wanted to destroy in her life. But anyway, such is, you know, that's just the top four. I'm sure the rest of them are fine. Oh, wait, Michael Gove is the Duchy of Lancaster. Yeah, I had to look that bloody thing up as well.
Oh, he's the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which is...
Sorry. That is very silly of me.
I think that's one of the estates that pays money to the royal family. I can't remember if that's the Prince of Wales's one or the Queen's one. I think the Queen's one's Cornwall. I might have those back to front, though. Anyway, sorry, sure. Continue.
Excellent. We just have a rubbery-faced man in charge of us. Doing a managed... No deal.
He's in charge of no deal planning, isn't he?
Yeah, which is a managed no deal, a managed exit into absolutely zero trade house. Anybody else? But anyway, that's about it.
I feel like you've missed the most important appointment by many people's standards.
Who do you think is the most important?
Well, Dominic Cummings.
He's not in the cabinet.
No, that is true, but there's been a disproportionate amount of coverage about him being chosen as senior advisor, and people have tended to use the phrase de facto chief of staff, because I don't know if we have chiefs of staff in the British system. It's more an American thing, isn't it? But Dominic Cummings is kind of the head backroom guy, I suppose. He's sort of like it almost feels like an Alastair Campbell type figure in terms of his, you know, alleged influence on government policy, or like a Seamus Milne style figure, to use a more.
So he was famous for leading the official Leave Vote campaign.
Yeah, he was campaign director of Vote Leave.
Yes, exactly. And so can be blamed for everything. And he, I am curious about this. Do you think that, like, do him and Boris Johnson actually have any? Do they get on in any way? Do they have a shared vision of what the UK is meant to be like? Because he, I don't know how true this is. But at least in the Brexit mockumentary that was it Channel 4 that put it together?
Yeah, the Uncivil War.
Yeah, the Uncivil War. So in that, he kind of, the character has a monologue where he's like, I just wanted you guys, I was giving you guys an opportunity and they've buggered it all up, essentially. And I'm curious to see, because I don't feel like he's the kind of person who really wants power. And I think one of the most interesting things about these appointments, and one of the most intuitive things that has been said by many other people, is that it looks like it's Vote Leave.
Yes,
That campaign group, and it looks like a campaign group rather than a group of people who are going to be competent at their jobs. For example, another reason Priti Patel is probably not a fantastic idea as a Home Secretary is because she used to go behind Theresa May's back and meet with foreign leaders without asking anyone, which is just like British people probably don't care that much, but that's objectively being bad at your job.
It's hard to see be insubordinate the further up the tree you go, as it were. I mean, she's quite near the top. Maybe her plan is to become Prime Minister, and then by definition, she can't insubordinate anyone because she's the top dog.
God, she's terrifying.
I just to wheel back to what you said about Dominic Cummings. I think if you sort of read some of his blog entries, which a lot of journalists have been doing over the past week, because he ran this blog where he posted these amazing stream of consciousness essays / ramblings where he just talked about various things that interested him and, you know, gave actually a lot of Brexiteers and a lot of Remainers quite a hard time, was clearly unimpressed with just about everyone. Other people have said this, but I think it's true that Boris Johnson is exactly the sort of politician that Dominic Cummings doesn't like.
Hake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's a bit mystifying as to why he'd want to join up with him, but Dominic Cummings does have a history of jumping onto campaign groups more, maybe, but politicians who used to work with Michael Gove, and just seeing it as an opportunity to actually do stuff and get stuff done.
Do you reckon he's just bored?
There must be an element of that, I'd have thought. It's an interesting question. What the fuck has he been doing for these past 2 years? Does anyone know, really? I know he's been writing these essays, but there's not that many of them. That must be like a morning's work tops.
Leaning back and just watching the country burn because of him, that must be quite satisfying.
I don't know. I think he's... this is another interesting contrast between Boris Johnson. Johnson is, I think, correctly seen as a man who doesn't have a very firm ideology, at least, and doesn't have very firm principles. He's just sort of in it for his own self-aggrandizement.
That's a very generous way of putting it.
It's a nice way of putting it. Cummings is someone who seems to have a flagrant disregard for his own reputation and being liked. And the only reason he seems to get involved in things is that he does have a vision that he wants to fulfill. We can argue about how, you know, how good that vision is and how well advised that vision is, but he seems to be driven by very opposite impulses to Boris Johnson. And I guess you could say there's maybe a yin and yang thing potentially going on there, but in many ways it's quite a baffling partnership, I think.
So there was, I think one of the interesting things that logically comes out of it looking like a campaign group rather than a competent government is the speculation that Boris Johnson will end up trying to go to the people in some kind of a vote, probably a general election. That time has... Was it today that they would have had to have triggered the general election?
People seem to be saying that when they get back in September, if they manage to call a vote of no confidence and bring Boris Johnson down on the first day that Parliament sits, then there'll just about be enough time. Although there are some, there's been a counterpoint to that, which is that the incumbent Prime Minister still has some leeway to actually set what date an election would be. And therefore, under that, Boris Johnson could schedule any election for after the 31st of October, which is when we, legally speaking, leave the EU, unless anything happens in the meantime. So there seem to be slightly mixed views on that, I think.
Can we just highlight the first leaving date that we were meant to do? Our first day out of the European Union was going to be April Fool's Day. And now the first day out of the day that we leave the European Union is going to be Halloween. It's almost like fate is telling us something.
Isn't the 31st our last day in the EU?
So yes.
It would actually be 1st of November, which I think is All Souls Day or something like that.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Sorry.
What do we do in All Souls Day?
I don't. Well, it used to be. I think it used to be the start of like the pagan New Year or something. I'm talking about my arse here, really. I'm not sure. I'm sure it is something like that, though.
Uh huh. If you were Boris Johnson, what would you be doing?
Well, what he appears to be doing, I'll get around to answering your question, is he appears to be gunning for no deal. He's put forward this $2.1 billion program of preparations for no deal, preparing businesses, and there's some sort of advertising / information campaign going on, border preparations and that sort of thing. And all of the rhetoric has been where we are going to leave. What phrase did, was it? Do or die or something? We are going to leave the EU. On the 31st of October. That's what he seems to be doing.
You know what? And it may actually end up being do and die.
Yeah, we did that phrase. You know, it's those two things are not mutually exclusive in just about any scenario, really. So, I think in some ways, I'm not sure what I think about this, to be honest, but he seems reluctant to actually go back and rehash the withdrawal agreement, although there's a school of thought that he's talking up no deal so that the EU will actually be more willing to go and make adjustments to that withdrawal agreement.
He still hasn't had a meeting or spoken with Leo Varadkar, is that correct?
Is that correct? He's been busy touring the UK, going to Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland and doing that.
Yeah, being booed everywhere. But apparently everyone's been telling him, oh no, Boris, they're saying Boo-oris, Boo-oris.
I don't know if I can answer your question. I mean, you're obviously a Remainer, so I don't know how useful this will be to ask you, but what would you do if you were in his shoes?
The reason I ask you is because, you still want to leave the European Union.
My preference is to go via the withdrawal agreement route, because I think it will be smoother and I think it's a more sensible way of going about things for all the reasons previously mentioned about the dangers of no deal. But the thing is, I'm not sure that he can get the withdrawal agreement through Parliament, and trying to do so necessitates a significant loss of face. I think in some ways he'd have a better chance than Theresa May, just because he's an actual leaver, whereas with Theresa May it was always a bit suspect what her motivations were, because she was a Remainer, and I think that created a certain relationship between her and hardline Brexiteers, and Boris Johnson would have a different relationship with hardline Brexiteers. Not least because he's invited a lot of them into his cabinet. Although that was
he has exactly the same problem as Theresa May does. Even if he goes for no deal, there is no majority for no deal in Parliament. And obviously it's the default that just happens. But I cannot believe that Boris Johnson, with the size of his ego, wants to be the guy that took the UK... and we use crashing for a reason. It is crashing out of the European Union, possibly, probably causing a recession, doing huge damage to businesses and to our reputation as a country on the international stage. And that would be his fault. That would be his legacy. And I think he's the kind of guy who thinks about that kind of stuff in really grandiose terms, or you assume so anyway. And I cannot believe that he wants to be associated with that, which is why I'm like, what is he up to? And I feel like a general election is the closest thing that he's going to be able to do, to be honest.
I think you can flip that logic on its head, that you're right, he does have this Churchillian view of himself, that point I made earlier about being self-aggrandizing. But you can equally see No Deal as quite flattering in those terms. You know, he can see himself as, you know, yes, okay, there are problems with No Deal, but I am the guy who actually took Britain out of the EU. I fulfilled the mandate of the referendum result. And I mean, he's probably assuming, if you follow my logic here, he would assume that Britain will survive No Deal and that he's the right man to actually get us through this
I do not believe he's never spoken in those. Maybe he has to a certain extent when he was campaigning to be prime minister among the Conservative electorate. But now that he's prime minister, he's actually gotten quite coy about how he talks about No Deal, saying that it isn't the priority, it isn't the outcome that he wants to have, which has been countered by a number of people in his cabinet, actually.
Well, also the funding and pledges, and also, you know, what Dominic Cummings said about, you know, No Deal will just happen automatically now, and there's nothing that any Remain MPs can do to stop that, ultimately.
I don't know. I think that this is going to be a really exhausting and interesting few months, because I cannot see, genuinely, I have no idea where it's going to go. You see, like the Brecon and Radnorshire by-election that we had, where the Conservatives lost a member of parliament, and the Liberal Democrats gained against them, because the Plaid Cymru and the Green Party decided to not field candidates to have more of a united Remain vote. You're seeing kind of like a real coordination across parties with Remain leaning MPs, and like that buoys me as a Remainer, as somebody who still thinks it's a really bad idea to leave the European Union with or certainly without a deal. And like,
I'd be very hesitant to actually see. I was going to say, I'd be very hesitant to see very much significance in the Brecon by-election result. I mean, firstly, you're not supposed to read very much into by-elections anyway, because they're quite unique events, and the way the media covers them is very different, or much more heavy-handed than the way they cover general elections. At least for that constituency. And it also, I think it enables more single-issue style campaigning, which is obviously what happened to some degree in that seat, because, as you say, there was a Remain alliance, and then the Brexit vote was split between the Tories and the Brexit Party. But you know, to a large degree, I think people, when they vote for MPs, I mean, we saw it in the 2017 general election, 80% of people voted for Labour or the Tories, who both at the time were saying, we are going to implement the referendum result. Obviously, the country isn't 80% Leave.
Implementing the referendum result doesn't mean No Deal, this is why I keep on coming back to the option of another referendum that confirms the way in which we leave. Or if seeing all of the reality of what's on of the options that are on the table, be they Theresa May's deal, a No Deal, or deciding now to stay, that's the only reason that you stop this farcical deadlock. And I really wish that were not seen as like an extreme Remain. Conspiracy to try and get us to stay in the European Union.
I mean, this doesn't really affect. I think you can still make the case for a second referendum, honestly. And there are some plausible sounding arguments to it. But the fact is, the People's Vote campaign is a extreme Remain conspiracy.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I think that that's a shame. But the reason that that leavers don't want, and I am talking right to you, Jimmy bloody Nichols, the reason that leavers don't want to have a second referendum is because they're scared that they will lose.
I'm not scared we'll lose. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, if leave were to lose a second referendum, I mean, we'd obviously end up remaining in the EU in some ways. By the logic of calling a second referendum, that would be fair. But I just think it is fundamentally dishonest to have a second referendum, basically just because a lot of people don't want to implement the result of the first. I think the basis for having a referendum in the first place, and it said this on that leaflet that they sent around to every household, is that the government will respect your decision and they will implement it. I know it was a legally advisory referendum, but, you know, in political terms, it was not an advisory referendum. It was an instruction. And the instruction was to leave.
I know that. Yeah, but we vote for parties that have policies in manifestos that do not get carried through. Mm. There is no guarantee in a general election that the party that gets into power is going to implement all of those policies.
Sure, and but this is a single issue referendum, so that comparison is not valid.
Yeah, but you can end up. I would argue that it isn't a single issue referendum because of all of the stuff that is put alongside this one question, like the way that we trade, like the way that we, like the way that our defence works, like the implications of it around everything else. The simplicity of it, I think, is actually quite false. But I don't have a problem with the UK deciding that it's changed its mind. Like, I think that is fine.
But even if we take it as read that a second referendum is philosophically legitimate, which I don't think is true, but let's say it is true for the sake of argument.
Oh, that's so nice that you said that it's true. Thank you.
What do you think it would do for the perception of democracy on the part of British voters if there were to be a second referendum and Remain were to win? Do you think that would be widely seen as legitimate, or do you think that would be seen as a bit of a stitch up?
I think that it's going to have negative connotations, obviously, but I think that a similar thing is going to happen with us leaving with no deal, because nobody talks about leaving with no deal. No one in that referendum. What is now being touted as one of the most likely options was never on the cards. And that, I think, is hugely undemocratic, because the implications of what happens to the country after that is going to be really bad. And obviously, we'll bounce back eventually. But that, I think, is so undemocratic. The fact that we're so blatantly lied to.
But, I mean, the reason we are in this state is not because of voters, it's because of MPs. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there was ample opportunity for Remain-leaning MPs, particularly within Labour, to block a no-deal Brexit by voting for the withdrawal agreement. That has been on the table for ages, right?
Yeah.
They chose not to do that, and now we're in this state where we are looking at no-deal because of people like them, many of whom are actually keen advocates of a second referendum.
If there had been a public appetite for Theresa May's Brexit deal, then it would have passed through Parliament. It's one of the least popular policies of any government ever, right? It had a 15% approval rating across the whole of the country. If it had actually been popular and people had been willing to make the compromises that she had presented to the country with regards to the backstop and the timeframes and all of those kinds of things, and still being tied in with the European Union for a certain period of time, then it would have been fine. But public opinion was not on her side.
I don't think public opinion was the main reason why people refused to vote for the withdrawal agreement. I'm sure in some instances that was the case.
No, I disagree. If there were public support for it, then it would have been fine.
MPs have, Parliament in general, has been very happy not to follow the public line on the public attitude to the EU. I mean, that is why we had to have a referendum, because MPs in general were so out of sync with the general public.
Now MPs seem to be pretty much in sync with the general public, and that they're split three ways on how we should actually decide to go forward with this.
In that sense... there is obviously a split. I don't know. I mean, does it align perfectly with how or well with how the public feel about deal or no deal or remaining?
I don't know.
Should we move on?
I don't know enough people in the United Kingdom. Yes, please, can we?
We can. What do we got? YouTube Union. Sorry, I need to actually introduce this because Jazz is too tired.
Please do. Thank you.
The YouTube Union. So, Jazzy, you actually, as you said, you wrote a paper on a previous iteration of a similar idea to this, which is that
it was very good.
It was very good.
It was highly commended. Second in my year. Thank you.
There you go. Did you mention you went to Oxford? I don't know if we've mentioned.
Oh no,
that yet.
Very rarely.
But the basic idea of a YouTube union is that content creators, to use the proper phrase, band together in order to get sort of more rights over their content, I suppose. Is that a fair summary of it?
A lot of there are various reasons why, but a lot of it comes to do with perceived frustration with not understanding why YouTube comes to a lot of its decisions. And there have been plenty of times when there have been frictions between creators and the platforms that they use. Not just YouTube, to be fair. And there's cases of kind of like ad rates not being transparent, the way that ads work not being transparent, of certain types of content, so for example LGBT content, being blocked, the shift of the way that the algorithm works not being transparent either, though that is a very difficult thing to be able to actually, with a self-learning algorithm, it can be very difficult to actually make any kind of make anything more clearer when it comes to the way that a self-learning algorithm works. But there is and also there's stuff like the insecurity of work, the insecurity of like a stable wage and all those kinds of things, lots of things that are kind of common with creative work and digital work. So we see this kind of instability with especially creative work, because it's seen as stuff that you should be able to, that you should do it for the love of it, and you should you shouldn't have to you shouldn't want lots and lots of money, for example, and especially in the US there are lots of problems with kind of like health insurance, and if you're a creator you're probably not going to be able to have access to health insurance because you're self-employed, because you're not a member of a union or any kind of like grouping. It makes it a lot harder for you to get competitive rates with health insurance and things like that. And so there's a various number of things that feed into the desire for there to be this kind of an organization in the creator ecosystem.
So are you broadly in favour of the things that the YouTube Union has asked for then?
So the YouTube Union, this new German example, is quite an interesting...
just to check, it's not actually German as such, is it? It's just allied to an actual German union.
So because of the nature of it, YouTube obviously is a... is an international organization. Everybody is kind of scattered around the world. It's one of the more complicated things about being able to organize under these types of conditions. But this is very much Germany and Europe and European Union based. So we do actually have kind of like one of the things that was particularly hard for the Internet Creators Guild, the USA attempt to organize by creators that closed a couple of months ago, was the fact that it was set up by its founder, Hank Green, and then there was not really anybody who was leading the thing. There was kind of like a director, but there was no like charismatic leader for people to rally behind, which is very common when we look at the history of trade unions and attempts at organizing and then being able to be successful. The interesting thing that we have here is a German creator called Jörg Sprave. That's not how you pronounce it. He's a creator with like a couple of million subscribers, and he has had a rocky past with the platform because he does a lot of stuff around weapons and the creation of weapons, and so has seen a lot of his content be in breaching the terms of service that he would have as a creator with YouTube. And so I'm like, he's probably uncontroversially, I can say that he is more controversial than Hank Green is, who mainly does stuff around kind of like nerd culture and stuff like that. But he is at least somebody who's throwing himself, who's throwing himself behind kind of like the success of this movement. I think there is a slight problem with the fact that it seems to be kind of just him at the moment, with a lot of other creators kind of like surrounding him, but it's very much his project, and I think that toxifies it a little bit and makes it more difficult for it to be unifying. But you do have this charismatic figure that in the past, that was one of the missing factors of the success of the Internet Creators Guild. So it will be interesting to see how this controversial man, Jörg, working with IG Metall, which is the largest trade union in Germany. Also, the fact that they've paired up with the largest trade union in Germany is really important because they get a ton of resources from them. I think that this is a really interesting thing that like people in this space should be looking at and wary of. I think he's been written off by a lot of commentators, but actually he ticks a lot of boxes that the Internet Creators Guild definitely doesn't.
I mean, couldn't you argue that in some ways it's better to have a controversial figure at the centre of this? Because, yeah, you're right that he does risk alienating people. But on the other hand, he has much more skin in the game than somebody like Hank Green, who, as you say, doesn't make controversial videos.
Yeah, hasn't actually been affected by a lot of the things that creators have had grievances about, right? This is a guy with first-hand experience. He can speak to that. I don't think we're necessarily going to see some of the largest creators in like across Europe even necessarily joining up to this, but this is a much more bullish attempt to organize than the Internet Creators Guild ever was. The Internet Creators Guild tended to work behind the scenes, actually had a huge amount of the ex-director Anthony D'Angelo released a blog post when the Internet Creators Guild in the USA closed, where he voiced his frustrations at not being able to talk about a lot of the stuff that the Internet Creators Guild was doing behind the scenes because of the amount of because of the amount of NDAs that they actually had to sign. For example,
who were they signing NDAs with?
With YouTube. So they'd work with YouTube on like the development of things and like opinions on stuff that's happening internally, but then they would never be able to tell their members about it, for example. And so FairTube, which is the German YouTuber union, has come in with like a list of bans, including being classed as like employees, and a ticking clock that they have to that YouTube has to respond to within that period of time.
By a ticking clock, you mean that when a YouTuber makes a request of some sort, they have to respond within a given time? Is that what you mean by that?
No, YouTube has to make an official statement on where and how it's going to kind of like recognize it within, at time of recording, 17 days.
It's
by the 23rd of August.
Right, okay. And what happens if YouTube don't respond in that time?
It's unclear, actually.
Is it unclear to you, or is it just unclear generally?
It is unclear generally, but I am like seeing the way that IG Metall have the largest trade union in Germany, the way that they have responded to this is quite it's interesting how bullish they are as well, and they are a union that is used to negotiating for millions and millions of people, and the expertise that they bring to this, they know what they're doing. They know how to negotiate, not necessarily with a company like YouTube, but it'll be certainly it's something to keep our eyes on. What do you think about this? Because obviously I can't give like a huge amount of my own personal opinion on this, but
well, something that struck me is, as you were saying, the Internet Creators Guild, if I've got the name right, was based in the US, which has a far weaker union culture than somewhere like Germany. Germany's union culture is actually strong enough that on a certain size of a company, it's actually mandated that an ordinary worker will sit on the board, which is actually something that Theresa May toyed with in the UK when she was sort of thinking about corporate governance reforms, but nothing ever came of it. So I think that aspect of it is very interesting, and the whole argument that that has been made that they're going to leverage the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU to basically just open up data so that creators can see more of what's going on around their videos. Judging by how some of the lawyers have responded in various news articles I've read, it sounds as though that's quite a promising line of inquiry. So I just think the legal and also just sort of the business culture environment in Germany seems to make this a lot more promising than previous attempts to unionize have been, I think.
It does, but one of the things that could slow this down and be a speed bump is the huge cultural disparity, the hugely different cultures, working cultures that these come from. YouTube is not only an American company, it is a Californian Silicon Valley company that comes out of this kind of like liberal libertarian mindset of kind of like being as restrictions are not Silicon Valley's best friend and not something that they necessarily want the most from. And seeing that come across and clash with one of the countries with the strongest workers' rights and traditional workers' rights in the world is certainly going to be interesting.
I mean, it's interesting you say that obviously Silicon Valley does have that kind of libertarian attitude to rules. It's the whole move fast and break things dogma. But I was almost going to jibe at you about what Nick Clegg said in relation to Facebook, that Facebook wants regulation now. And I mean, in relation to data privacy and that sort of thing, there's at least been noises made by the big tech companies in California that they actually want firmer rules about things. So do you not sense that there's any kind of appetite for... I guess platform companies when it comes to strengthening data rights around users of their platform that want to actually create content?
Sure.
I was just throwing that out there. I mean, it's something that I've heard. Well, the Facebook thing, I think, is actually a lot more cynical, really, in that it's easier for big companies to actually deal with regulation. So I think there's an element of cynicism just around when tech companies do ask for regulations. But just sort of speaking more broadly, Google in particular has actually come a cropper in a number of sorts of antitrust and competitive investigations taking place through the EU. And I think that there is, I mean, the whole writing of GDPR rules anyway is actually a bit of a blow against tech companies, and that it actually does put more power back into consumers' hands. So I think there's a general tilt in terms of at least the European attitude to how to regulate data companies. So I think that is also sort of cause for positive thoughts if you're someone that wants to be part of a YouTube union or something similar.
But also there are loads of things that YouTubers, YouTube creators, and YouTube the company can and should work together on, and some of it involves having some kind of a united and coordinated front in the face of a lot of this regulation, because a lot of the things that are being proposed are also probably going to have the possibility of hurting creators as much as they do the platform itself.
What are you thinking of in particular?
I mean, Article 17, what used to be Article 13, is like an example of this.
Is that the copyright thing?
Yes, exactly. The copyright directive.
Okay, and that's the thing that's been sort of described as banning memes.
Yeah, that's what it's been crudely described as, which isn't hugely accurate. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, surprise. But it's certainly, it doesn't have to be an antagonistic relationship. And actually, the ICGs was a very kind of collaborative relationship with YouTube. And it was, like, I think it was very productive for the period that it was around. It just didn't survive in an environment where it really worked or gelled with a lot of the ideology of also being a creator, which is quite also, it's born of the same space that Silicon Valley is born of. Like, it's very individualistic. It's very get up and go. It's very pull yourself up from your bootstraps. You can be whatever you want to be. Kind of attitudes that surround YouTube culture. But like, I think these forces are probably stronger when they work together than when they're against one another.
I mean, there's an analogy that sort of struck me just now as we were talking about this, but just another example of a similar thing in that the podcaster Sam Harris, who's sort of originally known as a New Atheist and who wrote a couple of books along those lines, actually quit Patreon for funding his podcast a little while back. I think it was within the last year at least. And his reasoning was that he didn't want to have to be he felt that he might be restricted by Patreon if he kept using them as a source of funding, and he was very keen to move all of his revenue streams to things that he had more control over. So obviously he has his own website and you can sign up for an account there and actually subscribe or donate money that way, and there's various other things, but it was all about him having more control and not being exposed to the sometimes what feel like quite arbitrary decisions that platforms like Patreon and I guess YouTube as well do make. But I think that sort of approach is only works if you're somebody big like Sam Harris, and the people who are probably most exposed to the kind of sometimes arbitrary rule enforcing of platforms like YouTube are the small and medium-sized content creators that don't have huge audiences and can't, and you know, don't really have the clout and the personal brand to actually strike off on their own. So that is an awful lot of power that that YouTube effectively has in that domain.
He took back control.
That would be a great comment if we were going to talk about Brexit in the next
segment. If only we were segueing and doing these topics in reverse.
What you should have done was, speaking of shitty working practices, Jared O'Mara, the Sheffield...
I cannot comment on that. So Jared O'Mara is the Sheffield Hallam MP. As Jimmy gleefully put, he is the young man who who unseated... Nick Clegg,
who's now the comms guy for Facebook.
Sir Nick Clegg.
Spin Doctor now Nick Clegg.
Yes, exactly. He was a young disabled guy, was very popular for what feels like a very short amount of time.
He was the original Momentum candidate, is how he was described.
Yeah.
And I think his beating Nick Clegg was was advertised at least by his own campaigners as a great victory for local organisation and grassroots movements and all of that sort of thing. But as you say, I can't remember when the allegations of him having sort of used racial and sexist slurs came out. This was on things like internet forums and other things like that.
Yeah, when he was younger.
When he was much younger.
He called gay people faggots and fudge packers. He sent really inappropriate texts to like female employees.
That was more recently, wasn't it? The text to female employees was within the last year or so, whereas the... Yeah. The slurs was before he was an MP, and I think before he was involved in politics as well.
Yeah, still called gay people fudge packers though. Apparently was really bad at his job. Just more broadly, which obviously doesn't excuse all of the stuff that he did. But
didn't turn up to vote and all that sort of, like, had a really bad attendance record.
Mm-hmm. Bless him. You think that I should? As we said in the introduction, he has now stepped down and will leave his seat in September. Which, if we don't have an election on the horizon, will trigger a by-election in Sheffield Hallam. you think that I should care a little bit more about this guy than I do already. Right, Jimmy?
Yes. So I mean, I think you're probably more sympathetic to my argument than you're currently letting on. But after it, so the way that Jared O'Mara's resignation was prompted was that his comms guy, I think his name's Gareth Arthur or Arnold, basically resigned via Jared O'Mara's Twitter account, sort of posted a bunch of messages calling O'Mara a twat, and also describing O'Mara's drinking problem, and also just calling him a disgraceful person, quote, disgustingly morally bankrupt. That was Gareth Arnold.
Yeah, it was really extreme. These Momentum guys, eh?
I mean, it was quite unprofessional, I think, I think you could say.
Yeah, he's never getting a job in comms ever again.
I mean, as someone who enjoys a good resignation, this was not the way to do it. It was not chill.
Yeah, exactly. It did really make Twitter very entertaining for about an afternoon.
It appeared quite late into the evening, if I remember correctly, and it was there was about an hour where people were finding it very funny, and it was very funny, to be fair. But underlying that, and this is an argument that Anoush Shakilian of the New Statesman made, is that, you know, O'Mara is not, he's done a lot of bad things. We talked about the slurs and his behaviour towards his staff as an MP. I'm not saying he's a great guy, but he is also a guy who shows very obvious signs of being quite seriously mentally unwell, which does not excuse his behaviour, but it should change our approach to dealing with it.
Including the alcoholism, he apparently downed a liter of vodka before going on a TV show. He's apparently developed an anxiety disorder since becoming a member of parliament, and has attempted suicide 3 times since he was resigned the Labour whip. And obviously you don't want anybody to go through that, even if they had called my people fudge packers.
Yeah, I mean, even if somebody is a shit, you know somebody could also could also be suffering from mental illness. And if you he released a statement on his website which sort of goes into some of the details that Jazza touched on just then, and he it sort of accuses the Labour Party of basically abandoning him after he won his seat, and he directs criticism particularly towards Jeremy Corbyn and Jeremy Corbyn's office, and just says that, you know, he was trying to get support so that, because, you know, he has cerebral palsy, so it's more difficult for him to actually participate in parliamentary debate and, you know, engage as an MP. But he didn't feel that he was adequately supported, including as his mental health deteriorated. And he felt, in his own words, that he was being discriminated against because he had these problems, and the right measures to actually address those problems were not, you know, being implemented. And whatever you think of what he did, I think that it's a pretty damning indictment of how Labour did fail to support him, at least if you believe that there's some substance to what he says about the Labour Party, which I do. I think that I doubt that he would make all of this up, basically. So not excusing his behaviour, but I think this is something that's come up in relation to kind of bullying allegations from other parts of the House of Commons, but the HR in Parliament is just really not up to scratch.
And do you think that this is a thing that needs to be done through Parliament, or is a responsibility of the parties? Because that's something that I think is the reason that it kind of has fallen through the cracks in such a way.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I don't think it's... admittedly, you know, O'Mara was kind of estranged from Labour because he was suspended while an investigation was taking place into his behaviour. And then I think about a year after that investigation started, he decided that he would resign the Labour whip and sit as an independent MP. But that was, by his account, it was off the back of not being supported. So he was isolated for like a long time before he actually stopped being a Labour MP. But I think a fair amount of it does rest on Parliament itself. I mean, you know, in legal terms, it is said that MPs are basically self-employed because they don't have a central HR function, and you know, they pay for staff out of an allowance that is allocated towards them, which can create problems, because you know that it does mean that if you're a staff of an MP and they behave badly, it's difficult to get redress for that reason. But I just think Parliament needs to sort of step up as a proper employer and implement proper HR policies, both to investigate misconduct, but also to actually support MPs if they're going through problems like Jared O'Mara seems to have been going through.
How do you justify that to the taxpayer?
Well, I mean, in a purely cynical way, we want these people to do a good job, and we want their staff to do a good job. Because you can't be an effective lawmaker if you're not supported when you have health problems, both mental and physical. You can't work properly for an MP if you're one of their staff if you don't have access to redress and other means of support. I mean, it's like any job, and I think you know, this does actually sort of link back to our previous topic, but yeah, there are sort of like interests that need to be balanced, but generally speaking, in this country, what we want people to actually be find their work rewarding, and we want to actually, in as much as possible, eliminate abuses of power and people using their greater leverage against weaker people to actually to abuse them. I mean, in this case, but I don't know. I'm just, you know, are you a bastard? I guess is what I would say to taxpayers. Because if you are a bastard, then you can say no, we can't be bothered to pay for these sort of things for our MPs. But if you're,
but I think they are bastards.
What, taxpayers?
Like the way that we're able to talk about, yeah, the way that we're able to talk about MPs' pay, when I think that objectively for a long time they are underpaid. Like they're not. It's not like they're poor. They're getting like 65, 70 grand a year.
That's 79 grand a year.
Is it 79 now? Whereas kind of like equivalent roles, so for example, like a head teacher or a GP get like over 100 grand. And it's, like that's a very hard sell to have to make to the electorate, and it's a very easy stick with which to bash them with in especially the right-leaning media. I think that you're right that there objectively needs to be some kind of like, I mean, protection, and also, you see parties step in here and look after MPs when they're going through this kind of stuff, and it's clear that there was just none of that appetite here. And actually, the real cruelty with which is, what was he, a social media officer or something?
Gareth Arnold, you mean? Yeah, he was a comms guy of some sort.
Yeah, there's real cruelty with doing, like stupidity. I hope it is hard for him to find a job, to be completely honest, because that's an incredibly unprofessional way.
Well, he even acknowledged that Jared O'Mara had an alcohol problem in his tweet. And, you shouldn't really be, not that people should be ashamed about having alcohol problems, but people are ashamed about it. And therefore, you shouldn't just go around telling other people that somebody has an alcohol problem or even mental health problems per se, because that should be a private issue. Unless someone's willing to talk about it, which is a different thing. Too many caveats in that sentence, but you know what I mean.
I think Gareth Arnold is probably the real bad guy here. The other bad guy.
There are two bad guys in this story, and then a system that doesn't work. I've only one last thing to say, which is I think MPs are actually paid enough. I know it is a tough job and they do work long hours, but I think you should be able to live off 80 grand. I think it's enough. I don't think they should necessarily be paid anymore, but they should have proper HR policies. So I'm giving back in that way.
Look at you. Give.
Should we wrap this up so that you could go to bed or just lie
please,
down?
Please, I'm actually dying. like my posture here has just gradually slumped and I'm now arched inches away from the actual computer. Follow us on Twitter or something.
I mean, if you don't know now where to find us, I guess you never will.
In the description, find us in the description.
I actually, just before you go, I want to read out a review that somebody posted on iTunes.
Is it a nice one?
Yeah, I think it's nice. Yeah, we've got 65 ratings now.
That's good.
And the most recent review just says, "This is." I just read the name. This is from Chel Dicko, who gave us 5 star and writes, "Great podcast. Wouldn't be the same without Jimmy." That's a full stop after that.
Oh, at least there's grammar. That's nice.
I feel that that's an indirect snub, but clearly I'm carrying this podcast by myself because he still gave us 5 stars. So they gave us 5 stars. So you can, if you want your review read out, you can go onto iTunes, if that's still something people do, and leave a review for us.
Thank you, Chell Dicko.
Should we wrap up?
Yeah, bye. Bye-bye. Find me at Jazza John on the internet. Jimmy JD Nichols, Right Dishonor.
Oh God, I think he's wasting away. We'll have to stop.